This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to one. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. We are talking about sleep. We have some sleep experts here with us to give you tips. A lot of us had trouble sleeping from the beginning or since we started to get older, but all of this has become worse during the pandemic. Let me give the numbers out again. 416-360-0740, toll free 1-866-740-4740. And we'll begin with a call from Louise in Toronto. Hello, Louise.
Hi, Libby. Great show.
Thank you.
Now, since I stopped working, I have difficulty sleeping. I have no problem about the coronavirus. I have no stress in my life. But when I was working, I was tired and I went to sleep. Now I can't seem to get tired enough to go to sleep. So can your experts recommend anything? And I'll hang up.
Okay.
Thank you.
Who wants to take that?
We need some more information here.
Okay.
Are you still there?
Yes.
Were you a shift worker?
Yes.
And what kind of shift did you have?
Mostly I worked the evening shift from 3 to 11, got home about 12:30 midnight, and went to bed around 2.
Yeah.
So got up at 10.
Yeah. So people that have worked shifts for many, many, many years, many of them assume that when they stop working and they try to switch over to like a normal daytime shift, sort of, you know, where they would awaken 6, 7, 8 in the morning and go to bed 11:30 and so forth, they actually have a lot of difficulty. And the reason they have a lot of difficulty is that the part of the brain, the suprachiasmatic nucleus, it's a long name, but it's a series of cells that controls the timing of when we're awake and when we are asleep. And it turns out that for many people, it is very difficult to switch to a normal daytime rhythm. So it's not unusual. What the person should probably do is go to a sleep clinic where they have someone who might be able to advise them on what they can do to switch to a better daytime being awake schedule. Some of the things that they may do, for example, if they're falling asleep very, very late, because that's what they've done for years and years, they might actually go out early in the morning, be exposed to light, because light actually synchronizes the person's circadian rhythm. So that's something that they might try to do. And one can also try a melatonin, which is a hormone that your brain normally produces, and that can sometimes be very effective as well. So there are options available, but the problem that was described is actually very, very common in people who had been shift workers.
Louise, yes, thanks for your call.
I agree. That is exactly the problem.
So hopefully you can find someone here to help you with that. Thanks for your call. Dr. Gorfinkel, it's interesting that we were just talking to Louise, who was a shift worker, because one of the things I was reading about said that the only sleep winners because of the pandemic are people who are night owls, because now they don't have to generally get up so early in the morning.
That's interesting. There are two basic groups. One group actually being better because of the pandemic, because they're working from home, because they don't have to commute any longer. My concern is that patients don't realize, I'm a GP, so I think in general terms, there is not an emotional or physical disease that you can name or I can name that doesn't cause fatigue and vice versa. So being tired, yes, you can have a primary sleep problem, but it can be related to other things. So it is important to see your doctor. People often come to me and they open their hands. What are they hoping to get? A sedative. And I have to reflect to them that sedative, sedate, that is a very different state than sleep. So let's call those drugs out. Oxazepam, lorazepam, diazepam, what do we know about them? They increase forgetfulness. They cause people to fall. They cause people to fracture. Yes, there are times that they're useful, but they have to be used with tremendous caution. So that's not our go-to when people cannot sleep.
That's a really, really, really good point. Let's take a question from Marie in Richmond Hill. Hi, Marie.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. What I wanted to know is I am a senior, but I go to bed around 9, 10 o'clock, and it never fails. I wake up at 5 o'clock in the morning, and I cannot fall back asleep again.
If you go to bed at 9 and wake up at 5, that's 8 hours.
I know, but still, I don't know why I can't go back to sleep again. I know it's 8 hours, but still, it just feels like I'm...
Yeah. It's because you have slept enough. In other words, you have gotten your 8 hours. In other words, you have slept enough. And if you're not sleepy, you're not going to be able to fall asleep.
So this is the question, Marie. Lots of questions here. Do you wake up feeling well rested, or do you wake up feeling exhausted?
I wake up rested. Yes. Yes, I do wake up rested, but I don't need to get up till 7.
Because 8 hours is a pretty good number. I mean, most people would be very happy with 8 hours. I'm just
right.
Curious.
Okay. Well, as long as I know that, then I'm okay to go.
Well, what if you go to bed a little later? Wake up a little later?
No, I still wake up at 5 o'clock.
Oh, okay. Well, it's 8 hours. That's pretty darn good. You don't want to sleep too much either.
And most seniors need anywhere between 6.5 hours and 7 hours a night. We need less sleep as we get older. When we're younger, we need more like 7 to 9 hours. That's what young adults need. So it sounds like it. If you're getting a solid 8, you're doing really, really well. So congratulations.
Okay. Well, thank you for the good news then.
Okay. Yeah, we've got good news. There's bad news and good news. We like the good news. So 8 hours sounds good to me. Let us go to Sita in Mississauga. Hi, Sita.
Hi, everyone. Have a happy Thanksgiving.
Thank you.
Yes.
Hello.
Hi, everyone. Sleep is my issue due to pain. No matter what I do, it's still a problem. I try natural remedies, warm milk, turkey meat, chamomile tea, melatonin, those natural ones. I don't drink coffee. I don't watch TV. I don't spend time on computer to throw off my time in. I don't have any personal issue or monetary issue. I go to bed... make the place dark as ever, quiet as ever, cool as possible, and still there's an issue. So I listen to the radio a lot in the night just to distract myself from that. I also get off the bed, like you said, it do get very frustrating, so you can't just fight it. I don't fight it anymore. I just take it easy, relax, and go to my happy place. But also a sleeping pill in and out because I need something stronger and close. Clozapam is the one that I take, and maybe once a week, not to get hooked on it. So, I did work for 17 years, the evening shift, and I never had a sleeping issue.
Somebody want to take that?
Well, thanks for sharing your experience, Sita.
Thank you.
The things you name are the things we call sleep hygiene. You know, all of those things make a lot of sense to help people sleep. So you mentioned that you were having trouble sleeping because of pain. So that leads me as a GP to ask, why are you in pain? What is that pain coming from? And is there a way we can address the primary cause of that pain? So, for example, if arthritis is keeping you up, well, perhaps we should think about methods to reduce the pain of the arthritis more specifically rather than focusing just on the symptom, which becomes I can't sleep because I'm in pain. So, no, sleep, pain, pain should not be treated with a sleep aid. Pain should be treated with something that reduces that pain, ideally identifying what the pain is and then addressing that cause.
Dr. Krieger, do you have anything to add?
Yeah, I mean, so when people aren't sleeping well, it turns out that they're much more sensitive to the sensation of pain.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
so that is, you know, that's important information to know. And I agree that the most important thing is to reduce the amount of pain, you know, depending on what causes it. And also using a sleeping pill once a week is not necessarily a great idea, especially something like clonazepam. I think that's what you said you were using.
Yep.
And because that medication has a fairly long half-life, and it may leave you the next day feeling a little bit dopey or drowsy.
When I do get that rest, it's a good rest, and I don't wake up being tired.
Let me ask you this. On most of the time when you don't use a sleeping pill, what do you feel like during the daytime?
Sorry?
What are you like during the daytime? Are you sleepy?
I have a lot of energy in my brain, but I am not overexhausted because I rest a lot. Like, I will get a sleep in between hours, a nap. I wouldn't say sleep, nap. But I have to go back and address the real issue. The real issue is fibromyalgia.
Yeah.
And that's not something can easily be under control with any, no matter what you do.
Yeah. You know, I have to hand it to you, Sita. You're doing a great job on recognizing all those natural things. Fibromyalgia is a chronic, lifelong condition for many people who have it. We know that low-impact aerobics is one of the most evidence-based ways in which to manage it. So that exercise piece should be brought into it. In my view, of course, watching the diet is critical as well. This isn't just purely a sleep problem. It is a multi-system problem.
It is.
Thanks
and it's all
so much for sharing that with us.
And it's all controlled by the brain, and it doesn't matter what you do. It's a lot to do with, yes, controlling how much I do, because I find the more I move, the more the muscle flares. That's where the pain comes from.
Mm-hmm.
So I have to really watch how much I do, how much I eat. But the most important part is getting that sleep. I've tried heavy herb. I've tried heavy vitamin. I take regular vitamins, which I do not give up. I stick to that. I do a lot of antitoxin, detoxin. It's a mm-hmm. lot of peace of mind. Nature, anything to do with nature, that's where I am. And it's not so much doing like physical exercise, but doing mental.
Sita, I hope that they've helped you with some tips, and thanks for calling. All right, we take one more. Barry in North York. Hi, Barry.
Good afternoon. Well, I'm glad you're talking about this, Linda, because a lot of people have problems. My friends do, too. I learned years ago a thing called sleep control, and here's how it works. First of all, you close your eyes. You try to relax your muscles as much as you can. When you're relaxed as much as you can from your head to your toe, then you picture yourself in front of a blackboard. You draw an X that represents 100. You then write in the right-hand corner, top right-hand corner, the word deeper, and you tell yourself, every time I go over the word deeper, I will go deeper and deeper into a more relaxed state, deeper than before. Then you erase the X, you put 99, and you do the exact same thing for each number, and it works every time. And I had a friend of mine say, it doesn't work. Well, the reason, the key part is this. You have to concentrate on what you're saying and believing that, because the moment you think of, let's see, what am I going to do this morning? Oh, I've got to do such a, you're out of it.
Okay.
I told it myself. It works really, really well. And the thing is that people, because it was a bit much to handle what I just said, offline, if you want, I can give you my contact information and they can contact me, because I've sent this to a lot of people.
Okay, well, it works. It obviously works for you. It's an interesting thought. Barry, we're just about out of time here. Thanks for your call. So what would you like to leave us with? I'm giving you 20 seconds each, starting with Dr. Gorfinkel.
My main message? Be as proactive as you would with diet or exercise. Ultimately, what gets measured gets managed, so it is important to take a pen and paper out. What time are you going to bed? What time are you going getting up? Be consistent. That makes a big difference. And avoid alcohol and sedatives because they sedate. They don't put you to sleep.
And Dr. Krieger?
Well, I think the most important thing is that people need to make sleep a priority. And if they're having trouble sleeping and it's interfering with their life or the lives of the people around them, they may need help, and there's help around the corner, usually in the sleep clinic, where they're used to seeing patients that are having sleep issues. If someone's had a problem for years and years and years with their sleep, obviously the things that they have tried have not worked. And so we commonly see people that, come into clinic and they've tried all the sleep hygiene stuff and it hasn't really helped a whole lot. And they may need extra help in learning how to fall asleep, or they may have a sleep disorder such as sleep apnea, which is incredibly common and does present, especially in women, with insomnia.
Okay. Sounds like at some point we'll have to do a follow-up on this very, very important topic. Thank you so much, Dr. Mayer Krieger and Dr. Iris Gorfinkel. We appreciate it.
Many thanks.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And that is all the time we have for today.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to 1. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back this holiday Monday. As all holiday Mondays, it's also a time to catch up on sleep. But many of us just can't. Insomnia is always a big problem, particularly for older people. And it's a problem that has affected many more people because of the pandemic. There's even a name for that. Coronasomnia. So let's talk to the experts and get some tips on how to get better sleep. We'd like to hear from you. Are you having trouble sleeping? Are you having more trouble sleeping because of the COVID pandemic? And do you have tips on how to fix that? 416-360-0740, toll-free 1-866-740-4740. And now I'd like to welcome Dr. Iris Gorfinkel, a Toronto-based family physician and founder of Prime Health Clinical Research, and Dr. Mayer Krieger, author of Mystery of Sleep, and also a professor of medicine and a clinical professor of nursing at Yale University. Hello, and thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Hello.
So, Dr. Krieger, how big a problem is coronasomnia?
Well, it's a tremendous problem, and the problem has evolved with time. Very, very early on in the pandemic, at least in North America, even before there were like any cases, people were already complaining of difficulty sleeping, and they called it pandemic insomnia at that time. There were also pandemic nightmares, and so people were having nightmares and trouble sleeping from the very beginning of the pandemic. And it really continues to this day, although things have changed a little bit.
Dr. Gorfinkel, are you seeing this in your practice here in Toronto?
Coronasomnia has been a major problem right from the onset of the pandemic. And why is that? People are tremendously fearful. And they're fearful still, even though they're vaccinated, because of the potential for breakthrough infections. They ask the question, and reasonably so, what happens if I go get my groceries and get COVID-19? It's a serious issue. And then on top of it, we have a whole nother group, those who have been infected with COVID-19, and despite having trouble with sleeping, are super fatigued the next day. So do we have easy solutions for these? We do not. So I would say coronasomnia is one, it's a small word for what's actually a tremendously large problem.
Dr. Krieger, does it come down to it's basically just stress?
Oh, no, no. It's way more than just stress. As we just heard, there are actually two or three different populations out there that are having trouble sleeping. The ones that I mentioned before who were under stress, looking at, you know, the stuff going on television, seeing what was going on very early on in the pandemic in Italy. And then we started to see people who were under stress because of things going around them. They knew people who got COVID. They were waiting for the vaccine to sort of come out, and there was a huge amount of stress related to that. And there was a lot of stress in Canada related to being able to get the vaccine. And we're now seeing and have seen from the very beginning of the pandemic people who have had COVID, and they've developed all sorts of sleep problems. Some of them are fatigue. Many of them have breathing problems a year and a half later because their lungs are still negatively affected by COVID. And we're also now seeing and have seen for several months breakthrough cases of patients who had been fully vaccinated getting COVID infection and also having trouble sleeping as a result. Some of the patients that we've seen have developed a condition where they stop breathing during sleep apnea. And it's different than the type of sleep apnea that we normally would see, because the type of sleep apnea that we're seeing is sometimes associated with people that have had neurological damage. They develop something called central apnea, not just the regular obstructive apnea. So there probably isn't a single day in clinic now that that I'm not seeing a patient who has a problem related directly to having had COVID. And so this is still a big problem, and it'll continue until the pandemic really disappears or really settles down.
Dr. Gorfinkel, have you seen any improvement now that certainly here in Canada or here in Ontario, you know, it seems to be coming under control a bit?
I'm excited by the fact that so many seniors have, in fact, been vaccinated. So there's no question that vaccination reduces the likelihood of getting the disease. It greatly reduces the likelihood of getting hospitalized and dying from the disease. And in fact, if you look at the data Canada-wide, well less than 2% of the ICU visits are relating to people who have been vaccinated. It's hugely protective. And, of course, there's natural patterns that older people have, even pre-pandemic, that make the so-called coronasomnia worse. And those sleep patterns are this. You know, as people age, it gets harder to fall asleep. They tend to have more awakenings altogether, less deep sleep, and there's an increased awareness of those awakenings. They tend to have more abrupt transitions between sleep and awakenings. So it's important to understand that that's your starting point. And then add to that the stress of the social isolation, the stress of the quarantines. It's been a rough go.
I'm wondering about the regular tips for sleeping. So let's start with, for instance, it's said that if you can't sleep and it's gone on for a while, like 20, 25 minutes, get up and get out of bed, Dr. Krieger. Is that a good one to start with?
Yeah, that's a very good one to start with. And the reason for that is that if people are lying in bed, not sleeping, they get frustrated, angry, and they just won't fall asleep. And they and so the act of trying to fall asleep in those patients and those people may actually they'll get wired as they're trying to fall asleep, and it becomes a conditioned reflex where they just won't fall asleep if they continue to just lie in bed and sort of fume about not sleeping. So that is a very, very good hint.
We have to take another break. I'm going to give the numbers out again. And people out there, I'd like to hear from you. Are you having trouble sleeping? Are you having more trouble since COVID hit? What are you trying to do about it? We have a couple of experts here also if you have questions. The numbers to call, 416-360-0740, toll free 1-866-740-4740. And we will be right back with more on sleep when we come back.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Now, Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Good afternoon and welcome and happy Thanksgiving. And of course, it's Monday, which means it's time for our Zoomer squad. And since we last talked, long-term care, the long-term care minister here in Ontario announced a package of measures, including $270 million to hire 4,000 PSWs and nurses by the end of March. Also in the last week, I had the first opportunity to interview long-term care minister Rod Phillips, and that happened after he had a phone call with Bill Van Gorder, CARP's chief policy officer, who, of course, is part of the Zoomer squad. And he joins me now along with David Kravitz, Vice President of Zoomer Media and Chief Membership Officer at CARP. Happy Thanksgiving, guys.
Happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving to all of you, too.
Bill, tell us about your call with the minister.
Yes, the morning after he made his announcement, Minister Phillips called me. We talked about the announcements that were in the speech from the throne and his plans for the next year. I was able to give him some feedback from CARP and what our members are thinking, and we agreed that we would meet in person, or at least in a Zoom call, for longer than the 15 minutes we had last week to go over our recommendations in detail.
So what did you think about what he announced?
Well, it was certainly better news than we've had for a long time, and I appreciated his honesty in terms. We were talking, for instance, about the increases needed in long-term care staff. We talked about there being 9,000 in the pipeline at the moment, and his hope that at least 4,000 of them would be trained and in place by next spring. He also admitted, and frankly, I was pleased to understand that he had a good grasp, that the biggest problem isn't hiring new people, it's retention, it's keeping them. And he talked about a focus in his ministry to make sure that the situation was such that people would want to stay with the jobs after they had them. Now, he didn't go into detail in that. I hope he will when we talk again. But it was good to know the minister understands it means much more to keep people than just to hire them for a month or two.
David, you know, it's interesting. I was talking to the head of SEIU Healthcare, which is one of the big unions, and this came as a bit of a surprise. She said, well, all those new graduates, they come in and they last an average of 3 days. That was pretty shocking.
Well, it is shocking. It is shocking. But I think it also speaks to the minister's apparent awareness of what it takes to keep them, because as I understand, and I got debriefed by Bill afterwards, that it isn't just the hourly wage, and well, that's very, very important, but how much do you know about the working conditions? How prepped are you for those working conditions? And I think part of the minister's plan is that the training is going to include more on-the-job exposure before you get turned loose with your certificate and then you hit the real world. And if that is true, then it does speak to some, you know, much-needed realism and problem-solving in the ministry rather than just, you know, rhetoric.
You know, David, one of the things that came across loud and clear, even from this government's critics, is like it's a big improvement over the previous minister, of course, Carp Lavie, to have her taken off the file.
Well, we did, and she was, and is significantly, too, and below the radar. They also replaced the deputy minister of long-term care. And we had run some commercials way back when talking about the salaries paid to the bureaucrats and, you know, what were they doing. And one of the things I find encouraging right now, and, of course, it'll all the proof will be ahead of us, but they do seem to be talking about measurable performance standards, very focused commitments to do very specific things rather than broad not just broad sweeping declarations of good intent. And I think that's maybe the sea change, because it is a big beast to tame, and Phillips can't come in and wave a magic wand and make everything good overnight. But if they're focusing on concrete, achievable steps that can be measured and can be evaluated, in the future as they go forward, I think that's a very healthy, a much healthier climate to get things done than just, you know, ringing declarations of desire, as it were.
Well, yeah, and an inability, you know. There was one thing that did make me think a little bit at the end of a conversation that I had, because on the one hand, it was clear Marilee Fullerton was completely ineffectual, but it was also, somebody pointed out that it was a matter of she didn't have Ford's ear. Bill, do you have a sense of that?
Oh, very, very, very much so. They were ignoring what she was saying. There was no impact at all from her in the inner circles. And you'll recall, even when we saw them two together during news conferences and media opportunities, she was not in the forefront. He wasn't giving her the support that she needed. And that should be different under Rod Phillips. Phillips is a much more experienced Minister Carp actually welcomed him and said that, you know, we really look forward to working with him and help him understand what our members are thinking, what older Canadians need. And we believe that he'll be able to have that influence on the Premier in a way that Marilee Fullerton never did.
Well, he also rolled up his sleeves right from the beginning. But, David, I mean, this is probably getting a little inside baseball, but do you think it was just that they figure they really have to deal with this going into an election and they're going to do it, whereas, you know, under her tenure, they didn't think that?
Well, I think so to a degree. I love to see Carp get a lot of the credit for that. I don't know to what degree, but we did deliver last week on Seniors Day. We did deliver a booklet to Premier Ford, Minister Fullerton, new Deputy Minister Matthews, Andrea Horvath, and Stephen Del Duca, a little booklet that was highlights from our petition and some of the comments we got from our members and some very specific demands going forward. And on the last page of that booklet, we said, we intend to make this the major issue in the election next June. We're going to be watching to see what you do between now and then. And I don't want to overstate it and say that that's what made them take the steps they did. But I think they realized two things, Libby. I think they realized this is a very much of a powder keg if they don't fix it. And I also think they realize that it's very much a management issue, that do you get people in there that know how to make things happen? Marilee Fullerton, as an MD, had a pretty accurate assessment of what was going forward. If you look at some of her statements early on in the pandemic and how she didn't necessarily agree with Williams, the chief public health official, who was kind of downplaying it a bit, it's not that she came to a deeply scientific, analytical conclusion about the COVID that was wrong. If anything, she was correct in her fears, but she didn't have either the managerial experience or the political heft to get her point of view across, and we saw what happened as a result. And then they got caught up in that whirlwind of disaster, and they didn't have anybody on board. To me, it's very significant that they finally replaced a deputy minister. They didn't have anybody on board who knew how to operate this stuff. And hopefully under Phillips, they will.
And David, it was either David or Bill, I don't remember, who pointed this out to me. That ministry, did you say, has 7,000 people working there?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, it does, and the rules, the regulations are in place for many of the things that we want to have happen now. They just weren't being instituted. So in the paper that we sent to Minister Phillips that caused him to give me a call last week, we asked for things that they can do immediately. And we did that for two reasons. One, because we want to have measurable results. But also, we realize, too, that there's an election next June, and they need to be able to say they really made some had made some accomplishments, made some progress. So things like reinstituting the unscheduled inspections of long-term care homes. I mean, there's no reason that shouldn't be had. That's entirely bureaucratic. I'm sure that neither Minister Fullerton or anybody else of the politician was saying, don't do it. It just wasn't done. And that was an unbelievable thing to have.
No, there was. They changed the whole regime. They changed the whole regime to inspections being in response to a complaint. That was that was on her watch.
That's right. Yeah, and they're going back to unscheduled inspections. We understand that's one of the things we're going to be talking to.
And fines and penalty. But also, I'd point out on the inspections thing, maybe that during the first hiatus that summer after wave one died out and before wave two, and they admitted this to the Morocco Commission later on, they did nothing all summer with inspections. They were relying on the homes to tell them, you okay now for wave two? You okay for infection prevention and control? Yeah, you are. Okay, fine. And they didn't send anybody in even after the first wave.
I know. I mean, to me,
ridiculous.
What they didn't do between the first and second wave is still... almost unforgivable, really.
It is. And so I think that's why they replaced some of the players.
Okay, so that's the Conservatives. Now, the NDP in Ontario has started to run some ads. And the NDP, of course, they critique everything the government does. But where are they with all of this?
I don't know. You might go first.
Everybody, well, don't all jump at once.
Making demands, talking about what they would do if they were in government, and they're not always realistic. And when you're not in power, it's easy to promise everything. We would like to see them make some more specific recommendations along these lines, and not recommendations that are going to take years to put in place.
Well, they're basically saying they're going to get rid of for-profit long-term care.
Yeah, well,
they're hanging their hat on that for sure.
Yeah, CARP's position on that has always been it's not a matter of for-profit or not-for-profit. It's a matter of individual homes, how they're managed and how they're enforced. And we know from the reports from our members, there are many, many not-for-profit homes that are not well-run. They don't have good leadership. They don't have trained and experienced people at the head, and they're having just as much or more problems than for-profit. We've got to, and to say that you're going to get rid of all for-profit long-term care, certainly in the short run, just isn't it doable. It's not practical. We need to make sure that all long-term care, whether it's for-profit or not for-profit, is working under the regulations, getting those regular inspections, and that everybody is enforced by meaningful fines and penalties for for those who don't follow it. And don't try to hide behind the for-profit, not-for-profit smokescreen.
Well, the other thing, David, that was I found very interesting, one of the critiques of this, even the latest, the 270 for 4,000 people, they said that because the government is unwilling to mandate that it be full-time work, even though they acknowledge that one of the biggest problems is a lot of this isn't full-time work, and PSWs and others have to cobble together, a couple of part-time gigs without benefits.
Right.
And they also reminded us that actually, the situation was similar in the nursing profession until Dalton McGuinty's government mandated that 70% had to be full-time. And to me, that makes a lot of sense, because if homes can save money by just giving people part-time work, why would they do it otherwise, voluntarily?
Well, I think there's two answers to that. One is, are you going to attack the method, or are you going to pay attention to the outcome? So if my goal is 4 hours of care per day per patient, and I'm around 3 now, and I want to get there in 3 years, how many workers do I need? How many hours do they need a log? So that's problem number one, and you may argue there that I should focus on how much care that people are getting and not so much whether it's full-time or part-time. But looking at the other side, what Phillips is saying is we have to really turn this into a profession. We have to turn this into a career. And in order to do that, we need better training, but we also need more on-the-job training. There might be more quasi-apprenticeship training. We've got to turn this into a career, because regardless of what you do with home care and community care, there was always going to be an increasing demand for some form of institutional care, let it be in a better institution, a different institution, better run institution. The sheer volume of people getting older means that there's always going to be an institutional component, and that better be much better run than it has been up till now. And so I think what Phillips is trying to do, reading between the lines, is get a short-term fix that immediately improves, you know, the people that are in there now, while moving toward a more long-term fix. And it might include a mix of the mandating, as you said, Libby, or higher wages.
Yeah, but I mean, he's dishing out the money for it. Why just not attach a condition to it? Hey, you're getting there. Apparently, they're getting their allocations next week. So if he tells Home X, you're getting $100,000, and 70% of what you use that for has to be full-time work. Like, why is that so hard?
On paper, it doesn't seem to be hard at all. There may be some operational lead times or things that they've got to go through to get there. But I also like the fact that he's willing to be measured on how many hours of care they're delivering.
So it's
they're promising it, and we'll see. But
well,
at least they, you know, promise something concrete.
Again, the analysis of Franche Elina, who is the NDP health critic, she said in terms of full time, part time, she basically said, "Well, the long term care lobby is close to the premier."
I don't know. Maybe they are. I don't think that they're as close to the premier as losing an election is as close to the premier.
Oh, okay. Well,
he'll throw anybody over. You know, watch and see how influential they are if he thinks he's going to lose an election over this.
That's interesting. Let us take a call from Eileen in Brampton. Hello, Eileen.
Hello there. I worked at the hospital in Brampton for 32 years, and when they talk about full-time and part-time, I was part-time who wanted to be part-time, but the idea of full-time didn't exist then either. They had the part-time and the casual people. Now, I wasn't in the nursing end of it. I was in the registration end of it, but the unions didn't seem any different on any of the other things. They it's the temporary or the part-time ran the place. You had very few full-time. It was to their benefit. It always was and always will be.
To the hospital's
now,
benefit.
Like they're going to do full-time jobs for people. Good luck, and I hope they see it, but it's never been a reality.
Okay, well, it was mandated a number of years ago for nurses when Dalton McGuinty was the premier.
And the
people in the professions.
Until 2014, that they had people that were part-time doing way more hours. And you know what? For all being said, a lot of the unions didn't seem to do much about that either. So until the... you're talking SEIU? Okay, SEIU changed in our hospital before I was left, and it was necessary to change. But let me tell you, you can't have the unions working with the management, which is basically what seemed to be going on for quite some time.
Okay, Eileen, thanks for that.
You're welcome.
Yeah, I mean, it's a big issue. I mean, being a PSW is a very tough job.
It is a tough job, and it's a very complicated problem. One of the other actions that we're going to be talking to Minister Phillips about is moving home and community care out of the Ministry of Health into the Ministry of Long-Term Care, because it's really one continuum, one package of looking after people. And one of the issues that we get into when we hire more people and make it more advantageous for people to work in long-term care, it takes staff out of the home and community care, where there are actually, of course, more people needing that care than are in long-term care. So one of the things we're urging them to do is not just look at staffing in the long-term care facilities. You've got to look at PSWs and other staffing across the whole continuum of where older Ontarians need this kind of help. And if they ignore home and community care, this time next year, we're going to be talking about the same problem in another area.
Well, interesting. I asked him about that, too. He said he's talking to the Minister of Health, or talks to her all the time. I'm not 100% sure what that means. I think he gets that it's a continuum. And I think, you know, by the way, people, I have a column on my experience with home care in the current issue of Zoomer magazine. You might want to have a look at it. But,
and a very interesting one it was.
So yeah,
you were complaining about middlemen. It was just,
oh my goodness,
scary reading.
If you remember the campaign, the Progressive Conservative campaign, so there's a whole layer of bureaucracy called LHINs, Local Health Integration Networks, that was brought in by Kathleen Wynne at great expense, like a big layer of bureaucracy. The Ford PCs promised to abolish it, right? When they came in 2018. But what we have now, if you call, is they changed the name of it. They're calling it home and community care. But it works exactly the same way. And it is, you have private companies delivering the care. You have government employees. They talk to each other. The patient is like non-existent in all of this. If you want to get anything done, like, I mean, read the column. And, you know, there are some people like Dr. Samir Sinha says, oh, they're overworked and you need them, because if you just left it to the people delivering the care, they'd give you a ton because they just build a government. But, you know, I just think that it's kind of a mess. I think their intention was to put it in these Ontario health teams, but really it should go in long-term care.
Well, it's part of long-term care by definition.
Yeah.
We know that 22%, I think Bill can correct me, I think it's 22% of the people in long-term care homes today could have been and would have preferred to be at home had there been enough home care. So right off the bat, you've got extra pressure on your long-term care system that could have been relieved by better home care. And sooner or later, they're going to start with the patient and work from there, rather than start with all the org chart boxes they have and figure out, you know, which box to squeeze the patient into, whether it fits or not, which is what they're doing now.
Well, yeah, and I mean, if we're running out of time and it shouldn't be about my opinion, but I also think that it's so politicized that you have people who are either liberals or further on the left saying, you know, the problem is the private companies, and then the people on the other side say the problem is the government bureaucracy, and I say maybe both are the problem.
Exactly.
Well, it's true, because even if you accepted, just for the sake of argument, that the problem is the private companies, how do you get from here to there? What do you do with the people in these homes now? So you obviously have to have a transitional plan that's going to take multiple years, and either lay that out if you're the NDP. What is your plan? What percentage goes private next year, the year after, the year after? And how do you get to zero? Instead of just talking about it as an ideological point, what's your operational point? And they don't have an operational point that I've seen.
The other thing is, think about it. Family doctors, the vast majority of family doctors are small, independent business people. They are private, right? It's just we have a single-payer system. You don't have a government bureaucrat second-guessing everything a doctor prescribes for you, right?
Nope.
That's what you have in home care, right? A professional says you need X, and then there's somebody who looks at it and says, man, no, maybe it's Y. I mean, it's by definition wasteful. Whoever it is that makes these decisions, you know, get somebody you trust.
Not only is it wasteful, but it leads to inconsistency across the whole province.
Oh, my God.
So we're not getting the same level of care in each of the limbs.
Okay, well, people, as a cross-promotion, have a peek. If this is something that interests you, have a peek at my column this month. We are basically out of time, starting with Bill. What would you like to leave us with?
Going to be very interested to report back to you how our conversation with Minister Phillips goes and how willing he is to force some of this immediate action that we're talking about.
David?
Keep an eye on the details. I think coming forward, both from CARP and hopefully on this program, we're going to be talking about specifics, rather than statements of good intent. And I think that's a good thing, because we'll have something to measure by finally.
Okay. Thank you so much, and very happy Thanksgiving, David Kravitz and Bill Van Gorder.
Thanks, Libby. Happy Thanksgiving, everyone.
Thank you.
Thanks, Libby.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Right. We are going to take a break. And when we come back, did you sleep in today? It's a holiday. How is your sleep, by the way? And how can it be better? We are going to delve into that when we come back.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.